Oh, hey. Hi. It's Lacey. We're back. Because when we left off with our second season, Fallout, on the Iran nuclear deal, there were a few things happening with Iran.
We begin with the crisis in Iran overnight. President Trump approving a military strike.
Iran used a surface-to-air missile to shoot down an American military drone.
Reversing course at the last minute with planes already in the air.
After that tanker incident that took place in the Gulf of Oman.
The president tweeting a short time ago that we were cocked and loaded to retaliate last night.
So we thought we'd take a step back to 2002.
America must not ignore the threat gathering against us.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
Another time when the drums of war were growing steadily louder.
No terrorist state poses a greater or more immediate threat to the security of our people than the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
It was summer when then-Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, Bill Burns, decided to give the argument for diplomacy one last go. He sat down with two colleagues, Ryan Crocker and David Pierce, and penned a memo called The Perfect Storm.
That particular memo flowed out of the most depressing brainstorming session I can remember over 3.5 decades in the Foreign Service.
The memo warned of regional destabilization, civil unrest, and declining European confidence in U.S. leadership. Secretary of State Colin Powell discussed the memo with President Bush and Condi Rice over dinner in August. But by then, it was too late. Post 9/11, the U.S. was having a moment, the kind where you feel like you need to throw your weight around a little. And the stage was set for war. But Burns and his colleagues were right.
I think we vastly underestimated how complicated it would be to restore a sense of security as well as political order after Saddam Hussein was toppled. We ended up expending huge amounts of American blood and treasure, huge consequences for Iraqi society as well.
Today, some have suggested that the U.S. might be having another moment. Military spending is the highest it's been since the height of the Iraq War. And the State Department is losing its diplomats in droves.
So we don't need all the people. Let me tell you, the one that matters is me. I'm the only one that matters.
At the same time, we find ourselves in the midst of another drumbeat, this time with Iran. I sat down with Ambassador Burns to ask whether that perfect storm memo might have lessons for us today. And I asked what motivated him to take a stand so contrary to the administration he was serving in 2002.
I just thought at the time, and I think today, that we could have contained that problem rather than, you know, use military force. And I think, you know, in many ways, after the huge shock to our system in 9/11 with the al-Qaeda attacks on the American homeland, we tended to invert the roles of force and diplomacy, you know, where diplomacy kind of became an under-resourced afterthought. And our investment was much more in military and intelligence tools during that period. Some of that was natural and understandable after that terrible attack, but it led us down a path, you know, whose consequences we're still paying today.
And in that 2003 memo, you mentioned that the consequences, the long-term consequences, could be that could benefit Iran ultimately. And do you see that that has played out in?
In some respects. I mean, it's not as if, you know, Iranian behavior wasn't threatening, you know, long before the mistake that we made in Iraq in 2003. But if you look at the reality that, you know, when we were attacked on 9/11, at that moment in September of 2001, you know, Iran on its east, you know, had a deeply hostile Taliban government in Afghanistan. To the west, they had a deeply hostile Saddam Hussein in Iraq. They had fought a bloody war throughout most of the 1980s with Iraq. And then with a span after the attack on 9/11, within a span of less than 3 years, you know, both of those regimes were removed. And so in a sense, I think that opened up a landscape of opportunities for Iranian troublemaking that they hadn't anticipated before that. So, yeah, one of the part of the collateral damage, I think, of, you know, the mistake we made in Iraq in 2003 was to open up opportunities for the sort of threatening Iranian actions that, you know, we're trying to cope with today.
So we find ourselves in another time where arguably, or maybe inarguably, you could say that, you know, the State Department, for example, has lost a lot of its career diplomats. It's lost quite a few people in general. We're in another place where you could say that the military tools are certainly taking over. So give us a gut check on Iran right now. Mm-hmm. Is your sense, and certainly it's been compared, the moment's been compared, would you go so far as to compare the two moments, or do you feel like they are?
Well, I mean, the difference, I think, is that I don't, you know, as many reservations as I have about this era in the Trump administration and foreign policy, I don't think the president himself is a military interventionist. But I think if in many respects, you know, the war in Iraq was an example of coercive diplomacy, which was all coercion and no diplomacy, my fear on our Iran strategy today is that it resembles that in the sense that, you know, maximum pressure, you know, the administration's effort through the unilateral reimposition of sanctions to squeeze the Iranian economy as hard as we can is not tethered, in my view, to clear or realistic goals. So in effect, you have tactics in search of a strategy. You know, I mean, if you could rightly judge that the goals here, at least on the part of some of the president's senior most advisors, is not so much a better nuclear deal, it's either the capitulation of this Iranian regime or its implosion. I don't need anybody to convince me that Iranians would be better off with a different leadership, but I don't think those goals are realistic at anything remotely resembling reasonable cost for the United States. And so that's, in my view, that's the similarity between the two outlooks right now and the two strategies. Because right now, I'm afraid that in dealing with Iran, a little more than a year after President Trump's deeply foolish decision to pull out of the Iranian nuclear agreement, is that, you know, hardliners, both in Washington and in Tehran, and there's no shortage in either capital right now, are becoming kind of mutual enablers, going up a very unsteady escalatory ladder. We're kind of boxing ourselves in on both sides, and that rarely ends well. And I think it's a prescription for collisions of the sort that we've already begun to see. Oftentimes, I think, we as Americans forget that our opponents get a vote too. And, you know, as much damage as we can inflict on the Iranian economy, and it's quite significant, this Iranian leadership, you know, is demonstrating that it can inflict damage of its own or at least create dilemmas for the United States. It's beginning to edge away from its compliance with at least important parts of the comprehensive nuclear agreement. And also, I think, is engaged in some, you know, low-level attacks in the Gulf, which are a reminder of the threat that it could pose to Gulf shipping and, you know, indirectly to the global economy. So that's my concern, is that we're pointed in a path right now that's going to lead to even bigger collisions.
So as Iran has moved past its uranium enrichment capacity under the nuclear deal, what is the significance of that moment, of that escalation, and of the moment that we find ourselves in right now, sort of post Iran having shot a U.S. drone out of the sky and over the Straits of Hormuz, and post all of this sort of escalatory rhetoric?
I think it's a very dangerous moment when the risks of, you know, of greater escalation and even bigger collisions are only going to grow over time unless we take a step back and the Iranians take a step back. I think so far what the Iranian leadership is doing is kind of testing the edges, you know, demonstrating kind of step by step rather than going 0 to 60. You know, they're testing the edges of the nuclear agreement, and in the case of their stockpile of enriched uranium, exceeding the limits that they agreed to. I think they're trying to calibrate this so that they, you know, retain the sympathy of our European allies, to try to push our European allies to help ease some of the economic pressure that they're feeling. But I think it's also a pretty vivid reminder that they have resources as well, and they're going to keep pushing, you know, unless the strategy changes. So I think there still is an opportunity to try to de-escalate. I think it would be in everybody's interest to do that, even if we're trying to find a pathway back to some kind of quiet talks in which we could raise our concerns about, you know, extending some of the timelines in the original nuclear agreement. The irony is, you know, you build on the foundation of existing agreements and try to, you know, address your concerns over time. And I think had we stuck with the comprehensive nuclear agreement, there would have been that opportunity. Now, having abandoned the agreement, I think we're making a very risky bet.
So you mentioned that our adversaries get a vote too. Having sat across from the Iranian negotiating team, having a much better sense than most people, what it is that they want and what it is that they're looking for. What is it now in this escalation that you see that Iran wants as a result of this back and forth?
Well, I think in the short term, what they want is to ease the economic pressure that they're under right now. I think it is having a pretty significant impact. And they're looking in the first instance to the Europeans or the Russians and Chinese, the other parties to the agreement, to take steps that might ease that pressure. You know, and ultimately, they'd like to reengage the United States if they could. The problem, of course, is since President Trump abandoned the agreement, their trust is pretty limited right now in any kind of negotiation with the United States. And what's also limited, I'm afraid, is the capacity of our European allies to ease much of that economic pressure over time. But I think in the short term, that's what they're looking for. You know, this Iranian regime, now 40 years after the revolution, is deeply opposed to negotiating purely under pressure. You know, the pressure that we built before we began the secret talks in President Obama's second term, beginning in 2013, was not an end in itself. We connected it to a willingness to sit down and negotiate. We also worked very closely with, you know, a range of allies and partners because the economic impact of those sanctions was significant in large part because it was international. It wasn't just American. And I think, you know, we've been quite dismissive of allies and partners in this administration. And while we can do a lot of economic damage, we haven't connected that pressure to realistic aims or diplomacy, which is all about trade-offs.
Are there some ways actually in which our maximum pressure strategy may be working against us in working with the Iranians? Because it may actually be anathema to what might encourage them to come to the table again and talk?
Yeah, no, if it's maximum pressure as an end in itself, unless your assumption is that you can impose enough pressure so that this regime will capitulate or implode. And by capitulate, I mean, you know, less than a year ago, Secretary of State Pompeo laid out 12 demands publicly across a whole range of issues in which Iran does objectively threaten our interests and the interests of our friends. I just think it's totally unrealistic to assume that they're going to cave across all 12 of those demands. And so the key, I think, if you wanted to engage in serious diplomacy, would be to send a signal quietly that they're not carved in stone. Because in effect, the message that those 12 demands sent was, when you guys become Sweden, you know, give us a call. And you know, again, none of this is a justification for threatening Iranian behavior over decades. But, you know, we have to be realistic about what you can achieve with pressure. And it has to be a means to an end, not an end in itself.
And in terms of signaling, we're actually sending a very different signal with North Korea. We are very much embracing a country that has nuclear weapons. What does Iran see when they see us doing that?
Well, I'm afraid the conclusion you could draw if you're sitting in Tehran right now, as you watch that exchange of love letters, what are in effect three summit meetings now between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, is, you know, the conclusion of Tehran could be that it pays to have nuclear weapons. You know, another lesson you could draw from this in dealing with North Korea, if you're the Trump administration, set aside the irony of what I'm about to say, is you could take a page from the book of our nuclear negotiations with the Iranians, in the sense that there's not a chance in the world that in the foreseeable future, Kim Jong-un is going to agree to fully denuclearize. So even if you preserve that as a long-term aim, as we should, the question is, how do you get from here to there? And you remember after the secret talks that Jake Sullivan and I and many others worked hard on, we did an interim agreement with the Iranians, which froze their program, rolled it back in some important respects, imposed quite intrusive verification and monitoring procedures, all in return for very limited sanctions relief. We preserved the bulk of it for the later comprehensive talks. If you could take a step like that, bearing in mind that the two situations are not perfectly analogous, since, you know, the Iranians didn't then and don't today have nuclear weapons. The North Koreans, as we speak today, you know, have dozens of nuclear weapons. And as time has gone on, they're expanding their capacity to make more and develop ballistic missiles. But if you could get an interim step like that with the North Koreans, based on the model of dealing with the Iranians, you know, that could be a significant step toward the ultimate goal of full denuclearization. So it cuts both ways. But my fear is that the conclusion the Iranians are drawing right now is the absolute worst one from our point of view, which is, you know, pays to have nuclear weapons.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about the collateral damage of not just pulling out of the deal, but this situation that we're in now. First, with our European allies. We're in a position now with our European allies where we've put them in a very tough position, sitting in between Iran and the United States. And neither side going either direction doesn't seem to be a good one. What are the long-term consequences of that?
Well, I think, you know, even in the medium term, we're widening the fissures between ourselves and our closest European allies, in effect doing Vladimir Putin's work for him. I think that's one, you know, large element of collateral damage. I think a second concern that I have about collateral damage is eroding the utility of sanctions as an instrument of American foreign policy. Now, I would be the first to acknowledge that we haven't always used sanctions wisely. We've overused that tool sometimes. But, you know, when we have used it effectively, as I would argue we did before we began the secret talks with the Iranians, you know, the early 2013, the minds of the Iranian leadership were focused. You know, their oil exports had dropped by 50% through international sanctions. The value of their currency had dropped by 50%. But as I said, you know, that pressure, those sanctions were not ends in themselves. They were connected to a serious interest in engaging them and in diplomacy aimed at preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. And I fear what, you know, we're doing to ourselves in a way now and doing to that instrument of economic sanctions through the unilateral reimposition of sanctions over the objections of lots of the people that collaborated with us to try to build pressure on Iran in the first instance, is we really are going to erode the utility of sanctions. Now, we're not going to see the effects of that tomorrow or next week or next year even, given the weight of the American financial system. But, you know, we're going to wake up in 4, 5, 6 years and find that instrument is no longer so strong. Even the foreign minister of Germany, and one of our closest allies in the world, about a year ago said publicly that all of us need to reduce our vulnerability to the U.S. financial system, which was a reflection of concern about, you know, the unilateral reimposition of sanctions.
So what about the more hawkish view that we really, say the John Bolton view, that we need to, in order to deal with an Iranian bomb, we need to bomb Iran. We need to get out in front of these issues and take care of them before they really become a problem.
Well, I'd say two things in response. I mean, first, it is absolutely true that you never get anywhere in diplomacy unless it's backed up by military leverage, the, you know, potential use of force, as well as economic leverage, and the political leverage that comes with working with allies, mobilizing coalitions, in this case, to isolate Iran. So that's absolutely true. I think the use of force, you have to be kind of unsentimental about this in looking at the Iranian nuclear program. If President Obama, for example, before we began the secret talks with the Iranians on the nuclear issue, had decided to use force at that moment, we could have set back the Iranian nuclear program by 2 or 3 years. But what we could not bomb away or wish away was the know-how that Iranians had developed. They knew their way around the nuclear fuel cycle. And what would have happened had we used force in that moment is that they would have gone underground with their nuclear program. They would have, over time, resuscitated it. And they would have weaponized, in my view. And so, you know, in that sense, there are limited, notwithstanding the huge strengths of the American military, there are limits to using that tool to deal with Iran's nuclear program in the way that it exists today.
So in your book, The Back Channel, you defend the practice of diplomacy. Why is that so important right now? And you may say that it's always been important, but is there something about this particular moment that is more so?
I think it's particularly important at this moment. You know, the reality is that while for a couple of decades after the end of the Cold War, the United States was the singular dominant player in the international system, today in 2019, we're no longer the only big kid on the geopolitical block. With the rise of China, the resurgence of Russia, we're faced, as is the rest of the international community, with some truly existential challenges: climate change, the revolution in technology, which is a different kind of challenge as well as an opportunity, that are beyond the capacity of any one state to deal with. I still think the United States has a better hand to play than any of our major rivals as you look at over the next two or three decades if we get our own act together. But I think that has to do not just with military leverage and economic leverage. It has to do with our capacity to draw on alliances and mobilize coalitions of countries. That's what sets us apart today from lonelier powers like China and Russia. Diplomacy ought to be our tool of first resort to take advantage of those assets. And what I worry about, especially in the Trump era, is that we're corroding that tool and squandering that asset at precisely the moment when smart, skillful, agile American diplomacy matters more than ever to promoting our interests cold-bloodedly on an international landscape that's much more crowded, contested, and complicated in some ways than the world we knew for the first 20 years after the end of the Cold War.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Burns.
My pleasure. It's great to be with you.
Ambassador William Burns served 5 presidents and retired as the State Department's number 2 official. He also led the Back Channel talks with Iran that paved the way to the Iran deal. Today, he's the head of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. His book is called The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. Things That Go Boom is a production of PRX and Inkstick Media. We also have a weekly global security newsletter called Critical State. Head over to InkstickMedia.com to sign up and visit us on social at InkstickMedia. Our show is produced by Ruth Morris. Catherine Fink is our assistant producer, and Mary Beth Kirshner is our story whisperer. Darian Shulman composes our music, and our engineer is Robin Wise. As always, thank you to the Carnegie Corporation of New York, Plowshares Fund, and N Square for making our show possible.